So welcome, everyone, to this June Solstice Ceremonial class. I'm Kaylin Castell. I'm here with Daniel Jamario on behalf of the Shamanic Astrology Mystery School, a 501c3 educational nonprofit. And our time together is about taking a deeper look at the shamanic timeline and what it is for you personally and for all of us collectively. And also, we'll be looking at the June solstice and doing a little journey. And then at the end of all that, we will open it up for Q&A. So if you have any personal questions or questions along the way that come up for you, be sure to jot them down so that you'll remember them when it's time for the Q&A. And then what we're going to do is have Daniel begin by creating a little sacred space and invoking the lineage of shamanic astrology. So take it away, Daniel.
Actually, I did think of one announcement I wanted to make first, Kaylin.
Sure.
Particularly since we have such a large number of people online, I wanted to say we have two spaces left for our Crop Circle Wales and Wiltshire adventure coming up on July 30th. And then we also have four spots left for the Portugal Cosmology event. I just wanted to bring that out there to let people know that because we're getting close to a final call, particularly on the Crop Circle one. Okay, so here's the what I always love to do at the beginning of any presentation about shamanic astrology is to invoke and to acknowledge the lineage that has inspired the creation of this paradigm and this school. So I want to thank the ancient ones, acknowledge the greater shamanic council of light, the teachings attributed to Hermes, Thoth, Trismegistus, Imhotep, and Lady Seshet of the Measuring Cord, from where the teachings of as above, so below, as within, so without have originated. I'm also extremely grateful to the Round Table, Avalon, and the Merlin, and the times that those represented when there was a balance between the masculine and feminine, when the heart and spirit and soul of men and women worked together as allies. I also want to acknowledge the Neolithic and the Megalithic Golden Age, a time period of gyliny, again, when there was harmony, very little warfare. And there was peace on the land and thousands of years of harmony and peace in contradiction to what our more recent scientists have told us about our history. And I want to also acknowledge the calendric wizardry of the Maya, and I want to acknowledge the ways in which the types of astrology we use today had been originated in India and in China and Mesoamerica and Mayaland and the brilliance of the Hellenistic culture in the invention of the sign-based, the seasonal zodiac, the sidereal zodiacs of the Babylonians and the Sumerians. So much to honor and acknowledge as we come to this solstice time, and this June solstice. And more recently, I want to acknowledge my teachers, which would be Dane Rajar, my mentor, also to acknowledge the archetypal visions of C.G. Jung, and also to acknowledge the wisdom teachings associated with DK and the Tibetan and esoteric astrology. And I also want to thank my own teachers that were not in physical form, Mount Haleakala on Maui, Mount Shasta, Wonderland of Rocks in Joshua Tree, and the sacred landscape of Western Ireland and the stone circles of the great north of Scotland, and so many other sources. And as we're doing this invocation, I'm wanting to invite all the rest of you to also call in your lineages where you have gained inspiration, and to have that also be present as we're going deeply into one of the mysteries that is represented by this teaching and also this season we're in now. So thank you very much for that. And I'll just briefly turn it over to, back over to Kaylin, and then we're going to launch into the material that is the teaching material for today.
Yes, that was beautiful, Daniel. Thank you. And I think that we're ready to jump into the timeline material now. So one of the things I just want to say to everybody is that you should have gotten a link to a handout that has been created for everyone around this. And it has really the essence of all of these cycles. and it also looks at the three worlds, what we'll be talking about, a lot of the different things. So if you can have that in front of you, and you can even maybe even take some notes around that as well, because there'll be some more things we'll be sharing around it. That's a good thing to do. And then I guess before we actually jump into that, I just want to say that we hope you'll, if you enjoy this event, that you'll join us for this online summit that we're going to be doing at the around the December solstice in preparation for the 2020 extraordinary lineup of Jupiter, Saturn, and Pluto. So we'll be sending more information about that. We don't have it all together yet, but just kind of feeding that as we jump in here.
Well, I'd like to actually start our diving into the timeline material and the initiation cycle material by just sort of giving a somewhat larger view on it first, is that there tend to be, I've noticed over the years since the creation of this body of knowledge starting back in 1970, there are like what we call the four crown jewels of the shamanic astrology paradigm. One, which we discussed last year, which is the 144 storylines, the way that we use the moon and the ascendant in a somewhat different way than in mainstream astrology. The second thing is our use of the synodic cycles. The third thing is the sacred marriage process, a particular way of looking at Venus and Mars as projections and combining that with relationship intent, but most importantly, the psychological and spiritual implications of the inner sacred marriage process. And the fourth of them, we
look at
yes.
Yeah, you just kind of cut out for a second. So I don't know if that was your internet cutting out for a second, but now you're back, so maybe it's good.
One second. And please.
Are you saying something to me, Daniel?
Just no.
You're cutting out a little bit.
Are you okay now?
Yeah, you're okay now. But if you're talking now, I'm not hearing you. Uh-oh. So I don't know if you're having, is your internet going up and down? What's going on?
Yes, it is. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
We have the most expensive system you can possibly get here, and wouldn't you know it, that there's some glitch with it happening right now. But if you can hear me now, I guess I can continue.
Yes, you can. Yeah, good.
Sorry. Oh, gosh, of all the days for that to happen. Yeah, so the timeline material. Now, what I want to share about this is that whenever I look at cycles, and in this paradigm, the way we look at it is there's like two different frames of reference. One would be the cycles that everyone goes through at around the same time, which is what we call the timeline cycles, like a Saturn return, like the Uranus opposition, like a Pluto square, even though that's not always at the same time, that's based on generations. And there's a really great power in the timeline material, because just by knowing somebody's age, you can kind of know what process they're going through. It gets a little complicated when there's two or three happening at the same time, but then there's also years where there aren't any of the timeline cycles happening. So that's the one framework, and we'll be looking at that in some detail here.
You're not downloading.
And then the second, thank you, Lynn. And then the second framework would be the outer planet transits to the inner planets and the most personal points on the chart. And that also will involve some of the exact same initiatory material, but not according to a organic timeline that is simply based upon your age. So those are the two frames of reference. Several introductory things to say about how we're approaching this before we get into some of the details. In this approach, we never ever look at any cycle as either good or bad. Every one of the cycles, even the ones that objectively are challenging and difficult, have an intention. The most important thing is to be able to determine the intention. And then the other part of it that is so valuable in this approach is to, and actually, you know, this is something that you can get from any kind of astrology, although the different systems will come up with different date ranges, would be the effective date range of the initiation. When does it begin? And when would it end? And then what we offer are navigation strategies for how to accomplish the intent of the initiatory process you happen to be in. So that was the first core idea, that it's not good or bad, right or wrong. It's not a sign of evolution or lower evolution or bad karma or anything like that. We need to get away from that kind of a framework. The other important factor here, just to put on the table, is that the initiations that we go through are not linear. So this is, it's actually more cyclical, but even sometimes irrational secular. So for example, many people believe that if you go through something and you make a great, great advance in your life, that the very next thing should be even better, as if it's some sort of gradient that is linear. And I learned something about self-love, so therefore, love will come into my life, or that I'll have more money, or that, you know, my health will improve. Well, but in the shamanic view, it's not really that linear. Actually, in the shamanic view, and we approach it to the astrological initiatory process, is that what you're usually hit with is something that you, at that level of awareness, are now able to handle. So in that sense, there's another principle we have to take into account here, that if something challenging happens, it doesn't mean, oh, you screwed up or that you failed your initiation. No, you now can handle what it is that's being presented to you. The other factor would be is that while it is possible to see some logic to a timeline, well, you know, at 45, well, then there's certain physical changes that happen. At puberty, there's certain physical changes. It's a logical process of going through one stage of initiation to the next, one stage of life to the next. But the outer planet transits can operate in extremely irrational ways. You can make this phenomenal breakthrough. You can actually handle a Saturn cycle the way that you could possibly, highest aspiration of what could happen. You graduated to the next level. The marriage happened. You moved. You told the truth about what wasn't working and what was working. And then you could be hit next by an underworld cycle. Yikes. Wow. Well, is that ever illogical that would happen or inelegant that would happen at that point? Another person could go through the very same cycle, and the very next thing that happens is that they have this acceleration, you know, like the doors open, and once again, everything in life becomes possible. So that's a very important principle here, that the cycles are not linear, and it's not like this gradient that everything gets better and better and better and better. Our awareness gets greater. Our capacity to handle the intentions of our life and the challenges of our life gets better, if we know the particular cycle we're in and we know how to navigate with it. Let me just pause for a moment and maybe I'll just turn it. By the way, for those that are listening, we're in extremely remote locations. I'm here in just outside of Metro Manila, and Kaylin is there in Tucson. So it's not quite as easy as if we were in the same room together. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Kaylin, and maybe you can get started in sharing about the three worlds. Kayla? Oh, no. Oh, my gosh. It's completely not working.
I'm sorry, Daniel, somehow I got muted.
Oh. Kaylin, so was I being heard?
Yeah, you were being heard completely fine.
I got really scared.
Yeah, I know. I know that feeling well. Anyway, I just wanted to follow up on something that you said, and that is that in terms of the cycles, and like if something happens where you know, then you find yourself in another cycle where you feel like maybe oftentimes what people can feel like is they failed or they didn't get it or they haven't done it right or something like that because they're still being challenged or they're being challenged in a different way when they go into the next cycle, whatever that might be. So the important thing to know is that it doesn't mean if things aren't working out in your life, like if you feel like you're going to the next level or whatever that's about, it doesn't mean that you failed or that you weren't good enough or that you weren't successful with the intent of that cycle. I just wanted to add that piece. So, yeah, this was really helpful information to me. When I first met Daniel, I had just gone through a divorce, and I felt like I had failed greatly, and it was so great to get the certain cycles that I had just been through. It was exactly what was intended to happen. That just helped me so much around all that.
Yeah,
so.
And Kaylin, out of that came that creation of that expression, rather than a marriage failing, but rather saying,
yes.
"Well, when did you complete your marriage?"
Yes. Yes. Which is a much better way to frame that than, to feel like you failed at it. So anyway, so we do look at the initiatory cycles as taking place of one of the three worlds, and this is from a shamanic model of the upper world, middle world, lower world. We tend to like to refer to the upper world as the celestial world, and in the handout, on page 3, you will see the three worlds, and that each of them is providing opportunities for healing and growth of wisdom through the specialized initiations that supports our soul's journey and growth. And each has a different way of doing that. The middle world is the world we live in. Sometimes we call it this world. And then the lower world is the underworld, or the place of death and rebirth, meant to be a place of empowerment. And so these three worlds have a different way of expressing, or the initiations are experienced differently depending on which world you're in, which initiatory journey you're in. And Uranus and Neptune are definitely represented by the celestial world, Saturn and Jupiter and the nodes by the middle world, and Pluto and Chiron by the underworld or the lower world. So, Daniel, do you want to do the descriptions? Like, you're really good at doing that, of the three worlds, what they mean.
A couple comments. First, the celestial world or upper world and the underworld or lower world are actually initiatory processes that exist outside of linear time. Which makes them purely initiatory. I mean, certainly the Saturn and Jupiter and middle world cycles can be seen as initiations, but they happen within time. There's actually some older forms of astrology, sometimes the more deterministic forms of astrology, some versions of astrology from India that don't even use the outer planets. It's pretty all middle world. It's just like a machine. Everything is that sort of mechanistic view of karma, and that's all like as if Saturn is ruling everything, while Saturn is only the lord of the middle world. The celestial world and the underworld make a huge contribution to our process, and they happen outside of time. So you cannot use the logical, rational way of looking at life that we think applies to life. I mean, after all, there is so much about life that is not rational or logical, although we assume that it is. We try to make it so. But the celestial world, upper world, Uranus and Neptune, and the underworld, Pluto and Chiron, do not happen within that same logical, rational time frame. Before going into some of the details about these most important initiatory processes, we actually use this material all the time in trying to address any question. You know, like if you're looking at what's happening in the world, and my God, there certainly is a hell of a lot to put our attention on right now that's happening externally, you know, politically, right, economically, and so on. The approach of shamanic astrology is to inquire into the event by taking into account all three worlds. You can't leave one out. So in the middle world perspective, it's like, yeah, we have to look at the facts. You know, are the oceans really dying? What about the climate change? How many nuclear weapons are there, and what are the odds about one of them going off? That's the negative way. The other way you could look at it and say, well, there is enough resources on the planet to feed everybody well. There's objective ways of assessing the situation in the middle world, the real world. Clearly, if you just stay there, it might get very easy to get quite depressed about the situation, because while the truth is that you could make it work for everybody, there's all kinds of end-game scenarios that could easily be assessed. But that's just the middle world. If we look at the celestial world perspective, which we have to do also at the same time, then that would be statements like, all is well. The universe is unfolding as it should. Let go and allow the whole process to happen because all is well. Now, there might be some people that are more middle world or more underworld based to hear that and they roll their eyes. You know, that's light polarization and spiritual bypass unwillingness to look at what's real or what the truth is. Well, but from the celestial perspective, that is absolutely the case. The material world isn't real anyway. It's all rising and falling without any essential foundational basis. So from the celestial perspective, yeah, all is well. The universe is unfolding as it should. And then from there come the irrational, non-linear events like grace, like the mechanism through which self-love actually can happen. Enlightenment, self-realization are aspects that are from the celestial that are not logical or rational. It's from the celestial perspective we say that astrology is the highest of the lower mysteries. The higher mysteries are things like grace and self-love and enlightenment and liberation and things like that. But astrology, by knowing about the celestial, knowing about the middle world, and in just a moment, the underworld, basically it's the highest of all the lower mysteries. And that includes, physics, psychology, economic. I mean, everything that's ever happened in the history of humanity can be encompassed within astrology, the highest of the lower mysteries. The underworld process also has to be taken into account. And that's where surrender is induced. So if you look at a world event, I mean, sure, annihilation could happen at any instant. There's actually a physicist some years ago that came up with an equation that described in his a differential calculus or some high version of math, was able to determine that it's possible that the entire known universe could wink out instantly. That sword of Damocles, that situation where we could be annihilated in any instant, our death could happen at any moment on an individual basis, that's the truth also. And so from the underworld perspective, we're really compelled to have some kind of awareness of who we are even if we went through a dark night of the soul, even if we went through, you know, the worst that could happen, who are we then should that occur? Who are we when if everything that we took to be real was annihilated? You know, so it's a spiritual initiation that is associated with the underworld journey. Some might think, well, why is Chiron in the underworld? Well, Chiron is certainly different than Pluto, but they both operate through irrational events that are not based upon logic. You know, so a person could have a fracture point. A person could have a really exceptional version of the one of the fracture points. You know, separation, violation, betrayal, lack of self-love. Those are all the usual suspects. But it's also possible that a person could have a specific wounding, an irrational kind of fracture point, and then they're forced to surrender because of that. And it's not because they did anything wrong. It's not about bad karma or anything like that. One of the things which occurs that is a principle in the shamanic astrology system is we have eliminated that mechanistic version of karma. I'm not suggesting that on some larger level, many lifetimes, millions of years, there isn't some Saturn-based karmic phenomena. But there's really very little value at this point in anyone thinking that if they go through something difficult, it's because it's their deficiency, their bad karma, they screwed up, it's punishment for anything. These are not original principles. I mean, if you go to India and you ask, well, about them, about karma, they'll say, the first thing they'll say about karma is, unfathomable are the ways of karma. So if you try to plug it into a Calvinist Christian perspective, you know, if you're poor, well, then God has already judged you as being unworthy. Or if you're rich, you've been, judged as being one of the elect. I mean, this is a part of the really major problem we find. And if you have a difficult situation in your life, it's no value whatsoever to think of it as bad karma or you're being punished. So that's just a little overview that we in any event, I mean, even looking at our own charts, we have to look at it them continuously from the perspective of all three worlds. And as we go through our lives, we're going to have all of the initiations associated with all three worlds at some point in our life. And it can be helpful to know which one is coming next and how to navigate it.
And sometimes we can have all three happening at once. And that's right. A whole other story, but yes.
Well, an example of that is that I have a great number of clients now that are born in the 1980s, that are like 36, 37, 38, 39 in that zone. And those that are like 37 now, a good two-thirds of them are going through three of them at the same time. In a very rare situation, there's very few generations will ever have a, quote, opportunity to have this occur. The nodal return, the Pluto square and the Saturn square at the same time. And, boy, that definitely is a, it stretches the skills of the astrologer to try to come up with a coherent strategy to suggest for a person who are going through all those three at the same time. Middle world, but then the primary underworld initiator, Pluto square Pluto. There are other examples of that that happen along the timeline. A lot of clientele that are 59 to 60 in that zone. And then there's that very, very interesting interweaving between how to work with the Jupiter return and how to work the Saturn return. Sometimes Jupiter return is first. Most of the time they operate together. And in some cases, the Jupiter return happens after the Saturn return. Each of them has its own unique expression. Kaylin, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
very, very good.
So I might be useful here to just come up with a couple of examples of the extreme difference between a middle world initiation, a celestial world initiation, and an underworld or lower world initiation. So I'm gonna start off by giving the example of a Pluto cycle. Pluto square Pluto, the timeline one, or Pluto in a square conjunction or an opposition to an inner planet or to an angle of your chart. These are rare. Why? Because Pluto takes 248 years to go around the whole chart. So there's certainly not going to be as many of these as, say, there would be a Jupiter transit or even a Saturn transit. So these Pluto ones are exceptionally important. And to speak this out in the most practical way, what happens when a person is in a Pluto initiatory process, which lasts about a year and two-thirds, is that there will be some event in some part of your life. It could be more than one. How many things in your life this will involve depends on other things, like, you know, what Pluto aspects you have, where it's located in the chart, and so on. But there will be at least one or more things that will happen where the three main ways of handling challenges will not work. What are those three main ways? Well, number one, people of action will use strength, muscle, or will to remove an obstacle. You know, classic Aries approach and some others. The second approach would be the thinking types, individuals that will look at an obstacle as a puzzle to solve, something to figure out. Very common. A lot of people do that all the time, and a lot of times it works. The third approach is called the varieties of denial. So it would be like, well, I didn't care about her anyway. It's all good. Well, I didn't care about that job. It's all fine. That's the kind of mentioned that before, kind of a spiritual bypass, pretending to detach from it and not care. There is one other version of denial, which would be like the workaholic approach, to stay so incredibly busy, overwhelmingly busy, that you don't notice an obstacle. But the point of the Pluto initiation is the fact that even though those are all fine techniques, and they work many times, many people use those techniques all the time, no criticism of them, in a Pluto cycle, none of them work. So the experience is one of irrational events, illogical events, chaos, conditions beyond our control, and it's the conditions for surrender. Now, I mean, from a spiritual perspective, surrender is one of the things we're hoping to get to. But as you would know, there is no technique for surrender. Were there a technique, then it's not surrender. So we could say that Pluto is the conspiracy of events designed to create surrender. But how this is completely different from Saturn is that it's not logical or rational. You cannot figure it out. It's not a punishment. You're not to take it personally. It's not because you could not have changed the condition. This happens a lot to individuals who really love someone, and they've identified with them taking care of the other person, and yet something happens, and that person, you know, is, you know, killed in an accident, or they get cancer, and you can't stop it. You know, it's like beyond your control, and that surrender happens. One of the greater challenges for some people is to not take it like, well, I did something wrong, I should have saved them. In the handout you have, these Pluto initiation processes, one of the expressions for it is shit happens. I mean, it's not like you can say, well, of course that happened because I screwed up, or of course that happened because I didn't pay attention. These are events that happen. Maybe one last thing about the Plutonian initiation I want to say right now is that there is elements of it that can be like the dark night of the soul. But as Jean Houston puts it in her works, that there's eight stages of the spiritual process, of the spiritual journey. Number seven is the dark night. So it doesn't happen at the beginning. It happens near the end. So essentially, it's a sign that you're close to the breakthrough, close to the surrender. Now, again, one other thing I should say, Kalen, is that before getting to one that's entirely different, and I almost forgot to do this now, is that when you talk about these Pluto cycles, you know, it sounds pretty dense. I mean, you know, grim, surrender, you know, it doesn't sound like fun. But in the from a shamanic perspective, and in the long history of the understanding of the underworld initiation, which you don't need to have the planet Pluto to know about the underworld initiation. I mean, we now know that the ancients would have known the underworld initiation by Venus conjunct the sun, Venus behind the sun, hidden by the glare of the sun, in the underworld, or Mars below the horizon, having gone behind the sun, like where Mars is now. Those are the ways the ancients would have known the underworld process. But what it is that we're leaving out is that once the surrender has happened, once the powerless has been owned, then there's an empowerment that comes. I mean, the word the plutocrat, you know, Pluto means wealth, not just the lord of the underworld. So there's a life force that happens to be in the center of the earth coming up. It's like the power of the cells. The cells become alive from the inside. And then there is this life force that rises, and an empowerment, a depth, and an internal sense of power that comes from having gone through the initiation. So there is that element of it. So it's that usually happens near the end of the initiatory process. So I mean, there that's I think that gives you a little taste of the Plutonian and one of the underworld initiations. Now, if we then looked at a middle world one, Saturn. Let's use Saturn. We have a view in shamanic astrology that Saturn, as he, and I'm putting in quotes, he, as he has been rendered in more recent times, is a product of a time, meaning it has a historicity that is based upon who has been in charge of the culture. If we go way further back, and the much larger history of humanity, before monotheism, before patriarchy, before patrilineal family descent, Saturn had a completely different implication. It was simply the rules of the game, like an operating manual. You know, you can't jump off the high chair, but there's the law of gravity. There's certain rules and regulations for which we can thrive and survive and so on. It did not have the patriarchal judgment, the guilt, the shame, the deficiency teachings, it didn't have with it that view that if you were perfect, then God would love you more, or that if you worked really hard and corresponded to what the outer authority said you should do, then there would be a payoff for you. There was none of that. None of that was in there at all. In fact, our view is that Saturn is actually more female. It's like the council of elders, the circle of grandmothers. Kind of goes along with our view of the revisioning of Capricorn as the circle of elders, council of grandmothers, and so on. These are feminine energies. Just like I think Pluto originally is more like Ereshkigal. It's a female underworld force, not the Hades brother trip with Zeus, right? Whether you take over the world for the patriarchy. So Saturn is a whole different thing than this. I mean, it certainly is it's the lord of time and cycles and life phases and all of that. And we could say that a Saturn initiation teaches us to grow and change and evolve via limitations and boundaries. Yes, via limitations and boundaries. But that's also how maturation happens. Is a snake is about to shed its skin, and the snake, let's say the snake has self-awareness, and it's looking down at these old skin coming off. You know, oh my God, I'm in deep trouble. It's over. I loved my skin. Well, not really, but it was mine. and at a certain point, you know, the skin is coming off, and the snake doesn't even know there's another skin. There's the fear that maybe it's the last skin. But the snake moves around a little bit, and the old skin is coming off, and then there's fresh, precious, new skin emerging. A new phase is emerging. So Saturn cycles, particularly the timeline Saturn cycles, are these maturation points. And because it's a middle world initiator, it's forcing a person to get real. What is the objective truth of your life? Well, I know I was born to be a therapist, and I've been doing it for 15 years, but I'm now in a Saturn cycle, and no one is showing up. Well, that simply might mean the universe is giving articulate instructions to do something different. Well, gee, I always did want to open my own restaurant instead. Well, the Saturn cycle might be a really, really good time in order to commit to that. So it's like a crossroads. It's a change in the game. It's a when it goes well, it's like a graduation point. The lawyer runs for judge. A person rolls up their sleeves and dives in. But this is happens based on having to objectively assess the boundaries, the limitations. If something isn't working out in a relationship in a Saturn cycle, it's not a time to ignore it. So to pay attention to the boundaries. And if you still want to make it work, then it's going to require a lot of work to take it to the next level. I'll just say that it can be assessed logically and rationally, unlike Pluto, unlike the underworld. So, I have these male clients, they'll tell me about what's happened in their love life. And, they're continually having rejection, or it hasn't worked out with this woman, let's say. It's a Saturn cycle, and they're breaking up. And we look at it and say, well, what do you expect? That's the seventh time you've chosen the same woman. You can change the game. Maybe the Saturn experience is an attempt to give you some articulate instructions about what not to do, to move in a different direction. So it is possible to figure it out, even if you don't like what the results are. It's like, gee, I really did want the clients to come. I really did want that relationship to work. But if it doesn't work by the end of that Saturn cycle, then it wasn't intended to. So that's just hopefully that gives a pretty good flavor to the essential difference between the underworld process and the middle world process of Saturn. But if we throw Jupiter in, I'll just mention something about Jupiter here, which is the other main middle world initiator. Saturn and Jupiter work so well together in the middle world. In fact, when you have a Jupiter and Saturn cycle happening at the same time, or should you be one of those individuals fortunate enough to have Jupiter and Saturn joined together on your natal chart, it's the balance between the excesses that can happen with both of them. Too much Saturn, too much limitation, and too much seriousness, we could say. Too much Jupiter, too much expansion, and too much over-enthusiasm, what would be the word? Almost to the point of megalomania, just so completely overboard. But if you put the two of them together, then you have the balance. They really support each other, and I always like to say when those two are together, that what you do well and the world needs to have done come together. So there's a harmony that can happen when those two are working together. Too much Jupiter, that can be a challenge. Too much Saturn, then you're confronting only boundaries, which is why, like in a Saturn cycle, one of the pieces of advice we give for navigating it is comprehensive sobriety. I'm not only speaking of, like, say, don't drink. It's not that. It's more like it is intended to be a serious time, a time period with a minimal amount of dopamine and endorphins, it's intended to be a time to have to objectively look at the situation and not to escape. That was a fairly long piece there. Let me turn it over to you, Kaylin. Maybe you can give some examples about the celestial.
Right. Well, I'm being a very celestial person myself, with lots of underworld going on as well, too. So the celestial world cycles are connected to Uranus and Neptune. And I think Daniel mentioned earlier that there's a we go through, and you can see it on the handout where it says the shamanic timeline, the ages of when we go through the cycles of these particular cycles. And that is Uranus around, the first square is around 21, 22, then the opposition that I actually started when I was 38, right before I turned 39, but now I think people are getting it more around 41 or 42. So there seems to be a range of time when that happens. And then the square at age 61, 62, and the return around between 82 and 84. So everyone's going to go through the Uranus cycle around that time. And, of course, Uranus is the change agent. It's the one that is revolutionizing how we see things, so what our perspective is, what our awareness is. So it's bringing in new ways of seeing things, or one of the ways that we've talked about it a lot is it shifts our assemblage point. And the assemblage point is the piece that is, you know, it's like, what is the keystone, or what is the belief that organizes our entire reality? And when that shifts, then our entire reality can shift. Actually literally had this experience in a Uranus cycle when I found out my first husband was having an affair. I just felt like I went into a free fall, and nothing in my world was the same from that moment on. It was like, you know, like I could, there was nothing to hang on to. There was nothing that looked familiar. I just felt like I'd fallen off a cliff, and I was just falling and falling and falling. So sometimes there'll be events that trigger that kind of an experience. And sometimes they can be amazing events. They don't have to be ones that are challenging. They can be, you know, like maybe you win the lottery, and that completely reorganizes your reality. So whatever it is that is there to help shift so it can expand our consciousness and awareness, so that we can have that experience of being more spacious and detached and coming from a more witness consciousness. And, you know, some of the statements, I think this statement actually comes from, I can't think of the guy's name right now, but Freedom from the Known. It's like whatever we have known.
That was Jeff Green. That was Jeff Green's statement about Uranus.
That was Jeff Green's statement? Oh,
Freedom from the Known.
There was this other guy. He did a lot on the 2012 thing. I'm trying to think of his name. Terrence McKenna. I thought he had also said that.
Well, who knows where Jeff got it from, you know? The way it's like, you know, nobody really owns these statements.
So whatever it is that you think you know, you don't know it anymore, and you're free from that. So it's like there's that can happen. It's like unexpected events that come into your life that take you in new directions. And when you are willing to go, you're not fighting, you're not resisting, but you're just going with the flow of what that new direction is. It often winds up that you, even though you had no idea, it takes you where you get there and you're like, oh my God, this is exactly where I wanted to go. just keeping that in mind, it's like if you're in the Uranus transit, to try to hang on and keep things the same is really working against the purpose of that particular cycle.
One of the biggest differences, the way to understand the difference between Uranus and Pluto, because both of them can operate from events that we weren't expecting. You know, it's like beyond our imagination. But the difference is that Uranus's design is to take us to other worlds. Pluto is to take us to the lower world or underworld. So the intention is different. So the assemblage point shift is not something to destroy where you're at because it was not good where you were at, but rather it's just simply time to go in a different direction, to expand to a different world. You gave an example that was somewhat challenging, you know, it rocked your world, but it could also be like being hit by lightning in a good way. And actually, my most recent marriage happened primarily under Uranus. I mean, it was kind of a Uranus-Mars thing that was happening, and completely unexpectedly, beyond my imagination. I wasn't looking for it, and it just came out of nowhere, and it completely changed my life. So it can happen that way, too.
Yes, it can. Right? So the idea, I guess, that Uranus is, because its purpose is to create change, and in that change to help expand our consciousness and awareness and give us a bigger picture overview. So sometimes what's been associated with Uranus is like revolution for evolution, or breakdown to breakthrough, and it's about connecting to, you know, those ideals of higher love and higher truth, and you know, so that can when we can surrender to that piece, and it's a different kind of surrender, because Uranus really operates more in a mental place, and Pluto operates more in the feeling place, and where you're really required to feel what you feel.
To be slightly more precise, excuse me, just one second.
Yeah, sure.
More from Uranus, more from a from a consciousness place.
Yeah.
Not necessarily
yes.
mental. Well, Pluto is by, you know, overlays and overrides all of that. In fact, it's
right.
designed to prevent consciousness from knowing what's going on.
Right. But they both, as you were saying, they both operate from chaos and overwhelm, and but for different purposes. Ultimately, right. Pluto is about empowering us to be more of who we are. And Uranus is designed to shift our assemblage point and to expand our awareness and our perspective. Mm-hmm. So whatever it takes for that to happen. And sometimes for some people, it takes a lot. Mm-hmm. For other people, they're more willing, and it can be a little bit of an easier process as a result. So being able to accept what is, to roll with whatever's going on, to really participate with the changes rather than trying to keep them from happening, because they're going to happen. It's just how challenging is it going to be for you? The more you try to hold on, the more intense the events become to get you to shift.
There's a sort of a principle we use and generalizes all of this, which is that the universe is supportive of human beings who are consciously participating with the cycle they're actually in. That if you know which one you're in and are in harmony with it, navigating with it, it's going to be way better than if you resist. If you
exactly.
resist, it's just, even if you successfully resist, that same kind of cycle is going to happen again later on. And the older you get, the more, more concrete, the more solid your structure will have become. And so it will require even more profound lightning strikes to break it apart, you know. So if you have an opportunity to have that occur earlier and go with it, it'll be far better, you know, in the latter stages of your life.
Yes. Right, because, you know, I remember having a client early on when I was first starting to do this, and she went through a Uranus cycle. She was very Saturnian. She just hated it.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, ah, mm-hmm. And she was so glad when it was over, because she didn't like all the unexpected things that kept happening to her.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, you know, maybe she didn't really get the essence of what that was about. I think she resisted mm-hmm. quite a lot. And so then the next time it came along, it was even more dramatic. And, you know, we could say Uranus is really about creating disruption to what it is that we know, and that's a good thing, because what happens, like, say if you have a seed, what happens for the seed is that in order for the seed to grow into something, it needs to be disrupted. The outside, the inside comes out, right? So
yeah, and then the parallel to that, if you're talking about seeds, is the parallel to that with Pluto is that it's extremely important every so often for things to be composted.
Yes. Right.
I use that word compost a lot these days when talking about Pluto. And we'll see another version of that when we talk about the solstice and we talk about the composting that happens at the galactic center. More about that here shortly. I'm going to just let me talk a little bit about Neptune.
Yes.
So, see, Neptune and Uranus are both allocated here to the upper world, the celestial world, but they're very different. Their process, of course, works in an entirely different way. Usually what happens in a Neptune process is you get the concentrated experience. It's more like an identity crisis kind of thing, where I forgot who I was. I forgot what was important to me. The middle world, the ground, is no longer meaningful. And so therefore, like, if a person happens to be, you know, like a really practical, achievement-oriented person, Neptune cycles are extremely disconcerting, you know, because I would say to such a person, you know, if you work 100 hours a day or only 10, it won't make any difference. So it's an entirely different set of sets of feedback that come from the universe in a Neptune cycle. If you are a fabulous therapist, for example, and no one shows up in a Neptune cycle, it has a completely different meaning than if it happened in a Saturn cycle. If it happens in a Neptune cycle, it's giving you the opportunity to do something different during that time. I sometimes will say to people in a primary Neptune cycle, the timeline one that happens in our early 40s, and or any other, like Neptune on the ascendant, Neptune on the midheaven, Neptune, you know, square or conjunct a personal planet, is that that may be, figuratively or literally, the time to go to India. Now, what for India would be for you? It's like to put the emphasis on your spiritual path, because the middle world isn't real during that time. It doesn't really matter. I mean, the only exception to that would be individuals that are primarily celestial world people only. You know, so if somebody gets to their Neptune square, you know, and they haven't really ever grounded, well, then we're not telling them to go to India during that time. but for most people, the Neptune cycles are an alternative to being addicted to the middle world. So you have an opportunity to explore more spiritual kinds of things, more transcendental kinds of things. Indigenous cultures have known about this one for a long time. I mean, it's the classic example of in Australia, the Aboriginal walkabout. It's time to go on your, we'd say, a Neptune cycle, right? So they leave their job, they wander out into the wilderness. The eagle is flying to the north. I guess I'll go that way. Well, I don't see the eagle anymore. Well, there's an interesting cloud formation over that way. Well, I'll go that way. You know, the person on the walkabout wanders through a village and they see this woman or man. Oh my God, it's my soulmate. But the eagle is continuing to fly to the north. I can't stay. I'm still on my walkabout. You know? So the point is, it's not the time in order to make those kinds of defined hardcore decisions. A practical example that I've seen with so many individuals in Neptune cycles, it's like you're lying in bed at night and you see stretched out in front of you multiple lines of probability. But no matter how hard you try, you cannot bring any of them into clear focus. So the advice to a person who's going through that, should they be in a Neptune cycle, don't mind. Stretch it out even more. Allow many, even more multiple lines of probability. Because it's not a definition, middle world manifestation time. I mean, that's a little flavor for Neptune there. Let me throw it back to you to say a few things about the nodal process.
So I just will quickly say also for me around Neptune, I feel like it's learning how to trust what you know, your inner knowing, in a way. You know, I've had several experiences of this where I've been in Neptune cycles and I could have followed somebody else's, you know, way or path or whatever because they seemed like they knew more of what they were doing. But having a really strong knowing that that wasn't really for me. And so following my own knowing and then it working out really, mm-hmm. really well, even though it didn't make logical sense, because it's not about logic or reason when you're in a Neptune cycle.
Right.
It's about trusting. Yeah. So the nodal process is these cycles happen about every 18 and a half years. There's certain lengths to the cycle. Nodal returns happen to get longer as you get older, and nodal reversals start out longer and get shorter as you get older. But they're really a process that's about getting us to connect with the time track that we're on. Why our soul is here, and that can kind of seem more linear. It's not necessarily that way, but it is definitely linked to our life purpose, why we're here, what's our destiny, and so nodal cycles are about opening the doors to our soul's purpose, but it's not necessarily going to happen in a way that is dramatic, or like in Pluto, where you just get dragged into the underworld whether you want to go or not. Things happen that are beyond your control. This may be that the opportunities come your way, and there's nothing that's forcing you to engage that opportunity. You get to make the choice. So it's important to pay attention when you're in a nodal cycle so that you can take advantage of the opportunities that may be presenting themselves. So nodal returns are really about getting that sense of destination, in a future-oriented direction, in a way that's going towards where it is we're meant to go. Whereas the south node, or a node, a transit from the south node, is more about coming from an origination point rather than a destination point. North node being the destination point, south node being the origination point on the time track of our life. And so, like the nodal reversal, it's when the south node is coming and aligning with the north node, and the north node is coming and aligning with the south node. That's more like a Saturn process, whereas the nodal return, when the north node is with the north node and the south node is with the south node, that's more like a Jupiter process.
The expression I like to use for both of them, the nodal return and the nodal reversal, and there's one of these processes about every 19 years. You can see on the handout the dates of these really important cycles, but the expression I like to use is realignment with original intent. So it's one of those time periods where there's an opportunity to once again connect in with, relative to your life phase, with what the life purpose themes are. What Kaylin was just mentioning is it's really how it works. Like the nodal reversal has more of a Saturn flavor, where you have to make an assessment. If I'm going to reach my life purpose themes, then I may have to change the way I've been living my life. But you're doing it out of a sense of awareness of what your destination point actually is. The nodal return, on the other hand, is like entering into a field of all possibilities. We call it a pregnant void, a womb of all possibilities. And that's this time frame of entering into that space with the awareness of current life purpose. And it can be quite magical, actually, where, like you knock on the door opens, we've been waiting for you. You don't have how many times in our life we tell our story and nobody knows what we're talking about. But in a nodal return, it can seem like the universe is there giving you clues, as if you're being contacted by your future self. The same thing happens with outer planet transits to the north node. I mean, it's like, our future self is reaching back and saying, yeah, that's it. That's your destination. That's the thing for you to choose now. So it's kind of like a combination of Jupiter and Saturn along the timeline, and that 18, 19 year time frame is just super important. At this stage of the game in the shamanic astrology paradigm, the nodes are at the top of the list of what it's important for us to look at. I mean, after all, it's the position by house of the nodes that allow us to create the storylines for our lineage and our current life purpose. So certainly the cycles associated with the nodes should be incredibly important. It's kind of like the eclipse seasons of our lives. So maybe
Beautiful.
That's all we need to say
well,
here
just
about...
Well, just one more thing
yes.
I wanted to say, Daniel, and that yeah. is the way that when for magic to happen in a person's life, there are three things that need to line up. That one is that yes. we're in alignment with our original intent or why we're here, what our soul's purpose is, that we have our tools together, and that we have the right timing. And so when all those three things come together, nodal cycles are definitely the time when that means that magic can happen. So, and that's just another piece to be tuned into. Yeah. Okay.
I thought of one other thing I wanted to cover about the, and kind of in a general sense, about how valuable the timeline approach is. And it's the thing I've been noticing ever since using the timeline, meaning just by knowing somebody's age, you can have a sense of what their main initiatory process is as the organic expression of a person's life from 0 to 88. I'm saying 88 because that would be like three Saturn returns, which could well be the idealized lifespan of a human being. Rajar thought it was the Uranian return, 84, but I think it's more likely in the history of the human race it's been 88. That's almost the same as the seculum, the age of the wisest elder, and so on. Anyway, what I wanted to say was you can tell just by a person's age because of the fact that in every decade, there are pockets of time that are dense and heavy, and it can feel like, oh, I'm old, it's finished, I don't want to have to struggle anymore. And then there will be other time periods in every decade that are youthening, like the doors are open. Once again, all things become possible. And the timeline will share how that is. So like in our 40s, the dense time is like around 44 to 46. 46 and a half to 48 is like the triple jackpot. All things again become possible. I can't go through all of these, but dense and heavy is certainly 58 to 60. But then 63 to 65 is a youthening time. In our 70s, the Jupiter return, and that happens in our early 70s, is another one of those youthening, all things become possible time. Just as we, those of you who are younger, you know, from the nodal reversal at 27 to 28 until the Saturn return is a dense, heavy one. But then it's followed by, oh my gosh, just like wide open set of possibilities, which is like 32 to the Jupiter return in the 30s. 23 to 24 is like all things are possible. So this is like this flavor that can show up based on where we are on the timeline. So that's just another way we can sense into this. And if you know the whole thing, then it actually gives us an advantage, because if you're in Pluto, you know it's not going to last forever. I got Jupiter coming up in a couple of years. You know, there's intentions for each of these different phases. So anyway, I think that's a good overview of this, what the seasons of our life and the initiation process and the navigation of it. Maybe we should turn our attention to the solstice itself.
Yeah, I just want to mention something about the shamanic timeline page that we've given everybody in the handout. And that is, you will see Venus returns, Mars returns, and Mercury returns also incorporated into the timeline. I don't have time to go into those now. They actually incorporate all three worlds within those cycles. So, and when you see them showing up with, like Daniel talking about there's a Saturn return with a nodal return. No, I think it was the Jupiter return and the Venus return that happens at age 72. You know, like there's certain ones, there's combinations of them that are more light and expansive energy, and they often include those return cycles of Venus, Mercury, and Mars. So, yeah. that's a conversation.
Yeah,
for
that was very important to add that, because we've been just talking about the outer planets and the allocation of those outer planets to the three worlds. And so, yeah, people are going to think, well, what about the inner planets? Well, it's because in their synodic cycles, 120 odd days for Mercury, 584 days for Venus, 26 months or so for Mars, all the worlds are incorporated into all the different phases of the synodic cycle. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Yep.
Yeah, so we wanted to talk a little bit about the June solstice. And, of course, we're not doing this class exactly at the solstice. That's because this is a weekend, right? the exact solstice is 9:24 p.m. on Tuesday the 20th Pacific time. But one of the things about a solstice, whether it's the December solstice or the June solstice, is that since solstice means sun stands still, there's very, very little, if any, difference for 3 days. And actually, as far as the eye seeing something on the horizon, we're talking about a few weeks where it looks like the sun is going to rise and set at exactly the same point, which is radically different from what happens at the equinoxes. I mean, if you're doing like a sunrise or sunset festival ceremony with a stone circle, for example, for the equinox, and you miss the day, it's actually moved quite a bit, because the sun is moving really fast at the equinoxes. But at the solstices, it's like it's slowed down. Sun stands still. So actually, you could do a solstice, a June solstice ceremony today or tomorrow, and basically you won't see any difference between today and if you did it on Tuesday. But then, you know, there can be value in knowing the exact date of the thing, too. Although for 3 days, you know, it's just really precise, that 3 days on the cross kind of thing, you know, which we'll be discussing here over these next few moments. But we're trying to come up with a version of astrology here that would be global, historical and global. And we cannot, at this point, be Northern Hemisphere chauvinists. We can't be, the American Hemisphere chauvinists. We have to look at the whole planet. So rather than saying summer solstice, that's only true of in the Northern Hemisphere. But we can, wherever we are on the planet, call this the June or the Cancer, the 0 degree Cancer solstice. Okay? And so that would be the same down there as it would be up here. So we have to be very careful when we look at the ancient ceremonial approach to the two solstices. In the Northern Hemisphere, and in many of the esoteric traditions, the summer solstice is the apex of the increase of the female force, while the winter solstice is the apex of the masculine force. But that's based upon Northern Hemisphere chauvinism. So I don't necessarily like to use that imagery. I'm more interested here, and this is something we've been working with for a long time, that I mm-hmm. think if we address this solstice as being associated with a place among the stars, then we can come up with great imagery about how to ceremonially work with this. So, Kaylin, you want to talk about the location of the June or zero Cancer solstice?
Yes. So there's a we won't see this because, of course, the sun's going to be there. Some of the slides that were on the page for the signing up for this event had images of the constellations and the stars that are around this place we call the Galactic Cross. So the plane of the solar system, also known as the ecliptic or the path that the planets follow, and the plane of the galaxy intersect in two places. One at the center of the galaxy, and that's where the December solstice is rising, and the other at the edge of the galaxy, and that happens to be where the June solstice is rising. And we know that these points, these seasonal points, move 1 degree every 72 years. So the zero cancer point was exactly on the cross in 1998, as was the zero Capricorn point on the cross at the Galactic Center in, at 1998. And that represents the major shift of an age. Ancient cultures saw this time of when the solstices or equinoxes, and they primarily worked with equinoxes in terms of the history that we have available to us, when they were on the cross. But now we have the solstices on the cross. And we could say 26,000 years ago, we would have had the same setup happening in the sky, because it takes about 26,000 years for each of these seasonal points to move through all the constellations and return to a starting point. The other thing that's really amazing about this part of the sky is it's the place of, there's a circle of stars that the native, especially Lakota people, referred to as the sacred hoop. And they create a circle with a cross inside of it, the cross of the plane of the galaxy and the cross of the plane of the solar system. And at the very center of that point, it's the center of the circle, and that's exactly where the June solstice sun is rising, regardless of what season you're going into, if you're in the northern hemisphere, summer, if you're in the winter, southern hemisphere, winter. And so this is a magical time, and we could imagine that it's at least 72 years. And if the starting point was in May of 1998, and Daniel did encourage a astronomer to calculate the exact center point of that, an astronomer named John Muse, who did calculate it and said it was in 1998, we would look at the 72-year window on either side, well, 36 years on either side of that, from 1962 to 2034. So each solstice is that we're experiencing between 1962 and 2034 is the sun on the cross. And the sun is on the cross for 3 days. So that kind of reminds us of a story. Anyway, so I'm sure there's more you want to say about that, Daniel.
Well, just that the larger mythic implications of this, and at one point I did some research on this, and there were like seven different places on the planet, ancient cultures that saw the same thing, which is this point of the galactic edge inside the circle of stars was the place where souls enter. It's an origination point, coming down the Milky Way through that circle of stars. There's so much to this. In fact, we have a whole cosmology teaching, of course. We do 5-day, 4-night training, which will be the Portugal thing over 6 days in September, to go into this in great depth. But there's an origin point. It was called the Silver Gate, that souls enter that point. So if you think of what's happening now, there's the sun on the origin point, below the Roman numeral 2, the, you know, the Gemini constellation, the twins, kind of going down the Milky Way, bypassing, having to go through the gates of duality, and then through this perfect equilateral triangle that that is right at the edge of the hoop, Betelgeuse, Procyon, and Sirius. It's so much profound imagery there. The opposite point, the galactic center point, was called the Golden Gate, which we now know is a black hole, the center of the galaxy, and that's like the exit point. So there's like an entrance point and an exit point. And I was mentioning this before, that it's like that it's where things get composted. But depending on how you want to look at it, the die-off goes to the galactic center, but from a consciousness perspective, we could also say the Golden Gate is the gate of ascension, of the highest consciousness, that would also happen there. So we have all this stuff happening at this June solstice, coming through the entrance gate. Mars is there also. The Sun-Mercury conjunction is happening right there. Soon Venus is going across the same point. So there's a huge amount of action happening right there in that portion of the sky, as highlighted by the solstice itself. We had one of the, I had an email from someone there's just so many, we could go in so many directions with this, but I just want to reference this one email that I got. Jesus was said to have been born on 1225, John the Baptist on 624. John was quoted as saying, "I am to decrease so he can increase," a reference to the sun's movement south from 624 and on the sun's movement north from 1225 on. John Major Jenkins has written about this, the way in which the Christian early Christian religion was based around these the sun on the cross, S-O-N-S-U-N on the cross, and we could go on and on about that. But she asked that we did address on this call the star connections to this. And that's what we were just doing, and I think uh-huh. that's the largest frame of reference, which is this larger story of the entrance and exit point, as represented by the Milky Way, going through right through the point of the two crosses, the Golden Gate and the Silver Gate, the entrance gate, and then the composting gate.
Right, and just something for people to know is that story of the sun on the cross actually comes from an even more ancient story that they were borrowing that story of the sun on the cross for 3 days I think it was Zoroastrian or something, and it was related to another god, and they just took that story and overlaid their story on it.
Mithraism story?
So anyway, so there's a lot of stories that have been told, and part of what we're looking at now here at this turning of an age, and we know that it's a big, major turning of an age with the solstices on the galactic crosses, that what are the stories we're coming up with now? How are we going to engage and connect with these consciously and dream into what is the new energy that we want to be bringing in? What's completing, what's ending, and what can we open to bring in the new energy around that? And just another piece around this particular summer solstice is there's going to be a Venus-Moon conjunction. Venus started her cycle. She rose as morning star. Technically on March 31st, the Aries metagoddess is the last time we have the Aries metagoddess or Aries overtone in our lifetime, because the next time she rises as morning star, she'll be in the sign of Pisces, not Aries. So she's in her descent process now, descending into the underworld. She's met with the moon twice, and her third meeting with the moon happens to be on the day of the summer solstice. Just about 6 hours before the exact solstice. So depending on, for people on the East Coast or further east, then they'll be experiencing the solstice in the early morning hours of the 21st, whereas people on the West Coast and time zones west of there will be experiencing it on the 20th. And the Venus-Moon conjunction is happening on the 20th and at the throat chakra. So as she goes into the underworld, she goes through each of these chakra gates, and this happens to be the voice of the goddess. And what is she releasing? What is she letting go of that prevents her from being able to speak what is true for her and do it in a good way, and also to be able to listen and to hear what other people have to say and then speak from what's true for her? So it's a quite remarkable time for this Venus gate, for this solstice. In a sense, we could say it's like a opportunity for the divine feminine to come forth and be able to say, or to be able to have her voice more fully than maybe perhaps she's ever had before.
Simultaneously, Mars has just begun his journey into the underworld, is on the other side of the sun with Mercury, going through, having just been essentially gored by the horns of the bull and sent into the underworld, and right. Hopefully going through some kind of of surrender, some kind of vulnerability, like on like a Sundance, or you know, some kind vulnerability experience where he can become aware and have some grief regarding what has happened on this planet through patriarchy. These are amazing backstories to this larger drama of the Golden Gate and the Silver Gate. This might be the exact time, because I'm noticing it's 25 past the hour to do the journey.
Yes. And just one quick thing before I do that, I just want to follow up on what you were saying about Mercury, because Mercury is going to be on the cross on June 21st in the early morning hours with the sun. And so to have Mercury and the sun come together at this point, at the solstice, is also not something that happens all that often.
And Mars going into the underworld exactly at zero Cancer, right at the entrance point. Also stunning.
Right. So this is a very remarkable solstice. So just for everyone to have that in mind as we do this journey, and I'm going to speak to some of it in the journey, but not all of it. So just so you have the bigger picture of what's going on. And Mercury also is the messenger, and part of what we're going to be doing in this journey is asking for a message. So, really, this is about engaging this special phase of the solar cycle. And, you know, in the northern hemisphere, it's the summer solstice, so it's the longest day and the shortest night. It's like a full moon. It's the most amount of light that's available. And at the December solstice, in the southern hemisphere, it's the winter solstice for them. And so it's the longest night and the shortest day, so it's more like a new moon time. So just keep that in mind as we go through this as well. And one of the things just to keep in mind is that this is a beautiful resonant polarity, similar to the idea of two sides of a coin. And in this case, the coin is the Earth. So before we begin, you might want to have a journal or something to write on or draw on handy in case you get a message that you want to jot down. And I always like to remind people not to listen to this if they're driving or doing something that really requires their full attention. So as we begin tuning into the June solstice through a more embodied experience or meditative experience journey, we're engaging the field of all possibilities that are present to us now with Venus, with Mercury, with Mars, with the Sun, all of that happening here on the Galactic Cross. So this is a way to participate with the sacred timing. So hopefully everyone is in a quiet, comfortable place and relaxed and can get settled. And as you're settling in, just take a moment to really allow your awareness to connect with your breath. And as you're breathing in, breathe into your belly and inhale the fullness of light or dark this time of year represents for you. And when you exhale, let go of any concerns that might prevent you from relaxing into the sacred space and sacred time. Continue to allow your awareness to be with your breath, and continue to relax your body, noticing where you may be holding tension, and simply let it go, relaxing even more deeply, with the intent to receive any insights, ahas, or messages that are available to you at this time. So when you breathe in, imagine that you're filling your body with the light of the solstice sun. And notice that you may now feel more consciously connected to the mysteries of the great below and the great above, as these two realms are informing each other, and they're informing you as well, and you are informing them. As we connect with these mysteries, we may notice how they are informing us and how we are informing them. And as you breathe out, send your breath up your spine and out the top of your head to the galactic edge, or the edge of our galaxy. This is the place where the souls enter this realm, where new information, awareness, and light codes are activating from beyond our galaxy. Allow your attention to become aware of how these mysteries are living through you. The galactic edge is where we connect with one of the many sacred stargates in this part of the sky, illuminated by the light of the sun that is inside of us as we connect with the light of the sun outside of us as it travels through the seasons and constellations in the sky. Breathing with this sacred connection, find where you are in deep resonance with this galactic energy that has a message for you coming from beyond what we think of as ordinary reality. Notice how this stargate is sending through information for you that you may or may not make logical sense to you. Are you willing to trust these insights? You might receive a symbol or an image or a word or a mantra. Maybe you're not really receiving anything. That's okay, as the message may become more clear through a dream or later meditation or when you're spending time in nature, perhaps spending time with the solstice sun as it rises or sets or tracks across the sky. Know that this message is meant to help you tune into what the intended focus is for you that will support you in navigating this coming season. Keeping in mind that the solstice, this particular solstice occurs at zero Cancer, no matter what hemisphere you're in, you may find that your message is about nurturing and nourishing your body and being. Maybe it's about allowing more fully an ability to align with your soul's purpose. Maybe it's about detoxing, strengthening, enjoying, making a commitment to yourself or to a task that is calling to you, having more fun, spending more time in nature, or anything else that may be coming up for you. So this solstice time is an enhanced between experience, between seasons, between great ages, between light and dark, between the worlds, where magic and alchemy are so much more easily accessible when we are aware and willing to dream into what is next for us. Are you inspired and excited by what you see? Are you uncertain, hesitant, maybe even a little scared to embrace this vision of what you are seeing as your guidance? What would it take for you to fully commit to furthering the visions you feel most aligned with? What action is most necessary? What can you do to make sure this vision, this message, finds fruition through you? Whatever your vision, it is a blessing, as you are a blessing to this life. Know that you are deeply loved, and you are always being guided when you allow that into your life. With gratitude, know this is already accomplished, and all heaven and earth rejoice. So now it's time to return back to your reality, to your physical body. And when you feel ready, take a few moments to draw or write some notes about what came through for you. And we're also going to go ahead, just in the interest of time, start the Q&A session. And so if you have any questions about anything we've covered so far, maybe you have a personal chart question, if you have insights you want to share, or something that came through for you in the meditation, we want to hear from you. So let me turn the Q&A on. And pressing star 6 will put you in the queue. Okay, cool. So I'm going to go ahead and take the first question or comment or insight or whatever. Here we go. Hello.
Hello.
Innocent.
Am I on? Hi, this is
you
Katie.
Are.
This Katie. Is Katie Morikawa.
Oh, my
really?
God. Loving hearing you guys, and it's inspiring to reconnect. And anyway, I have specific questions. One was, Daniel, you made this offhand comment about Neptune, sort of navigation advice for people who are already primarily celestial oriented, and they're in a Neptune cycle. And I was just curious, what are your comments on that?
People that maybe have been over-identified with the celestial world and then they're in a Neptune cycle, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably the most important thing there would be to inquire into whether any of those habits that keep a person in the celestial all the time are some form of an addiction. If they... that a person is too comfortable there, because after all, we do have to have an awareness of all three worlds. I mean, you know, each person, I mean, some charts definitely are individuals. I'm not trying to say they all three have to be balanced all the time. But in that Neptune cycle, the advice would be not during that time to say, this is when you do your ayahuasca adventure, if you've been doing ayahuasca all along, you know, your life. If you meditate 20 hours a day and that's kept you out of the middle world, you wouldn't do that during the Neptune cycle. So it's really a time to get another kind of guidance, another kind of guidance that it doesn't necessarily mean that you become all Saturn during that time, but to be very careful that a way of life is not some kind of an addiction. In the same way that a Neptune cycle for a person who is all middle world, you know, then Neptune is informing them that maybe you've been over-identified with the middle world. So it's really an inquiry into whether you're over-identified with the celestial.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that make any sense?
It sort of does. Do you have examples that you've observed, you know, people going through this and the kind of things that they encounter, the challenges that they face, and the things that have been helpful for them and productive going through Neptune cycle?
You mean if they've already been so Neptunized?
Yeah, like a case story. Maybe not super specific, but I've just not encountered it before, so I was just curious.
The few times that I've encountered it, I don't during that time period pretend as the astrologer that I can also be their therapist. So I probably in such a situation, if I become aware that an individual is not going to benefit that much from the usual Neptune navigation strategy, I would be more interested at that point in having them have other resources to ground their life, to make sure that they're not too lost in their Neptune approach. And I would actually seek out more expert guidance than what I can offer as an astrologer.
Okay. So it's kind of like their opportunity to connect with the inner teacher at another level, and maybe sort of revise their practice or reevaluate their spiritual practice. Okay.
That makes it. I'm in agreement with that. Yes, and particularly if a person has been, for good or ill, totally like only been living in the celestial world. And they could encounter in the Neptune cycle a real challenge to their sanity. In other time periods, Neptune is an antidote to too much rigidity and structure. You know, so it's okay to not know who you are. You know, if for that kind of an individual, that's a good thing to go through in a Neptune cycle. I don't know who I am, but if you've been living in that place for a long time, and then you go into a Neptune cycle, then it's more than just an adjustment of your spiritual practice. It's it might be where you really do need to have additional guidance to reconnect you to greater balance.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. That's helpful. And then my other question, besides just being so happy talking to you guys, is so do I take it that, Daniel, you're now categorizing the nodes as a celestial level?
No.
Process? No, okay. Because you had talked about it with it. Okay, all right, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yay! So great to hear from you, Katie.
I know.
So often I think about you and wonder where you are and whether we'd hear from you again. So it's really excellent. Thank you, Katie.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much. Love you guys. Right.
Love you too.
Too.
Bye.
All right. Okay. How do I get out of this? Are you going to?
Oh, I'm going to take you out.
Okay, so who am I talking to now?
This is Sophia Mona Lisa.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Can you hear me, dear?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is what's going on for me right now. And first, I just want to make a brief comment that you said something about, you know, the summer solstice here and then the winter solstice, I guess, below the equator. So I find it interesting that I'm here. In Florida, my son happens to be in Australia at this time, so I just kind of feel a connection, like somehow being able to experience both simultaneously. I just thought I'd remark on that.
Yeah, that's great.
But what's happening for me is I'm having my second lunar return while I have been and am having Pluto conjunct my son and my descendant. And so I'm just wondering, you know, as we're going into this solstice, if anything might stand out to you in terms of what I should be looking at for, you know, what's next for me.
So when you say the second lunar return, are you about 54, 55?
Yes, I am 54.
Okay. All right. That's Do we have that on the timeline? I think we do.
I think so. Yeah, the progressed lunar return. Yeah.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that.
So if you have, so you're having Pluto on your descendant. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It's conjunct my son and my descendant.
How close to the descendant?
3 degrees.
Okay, and how close to the sun?
1 degree.
Okay. Well, the inquiry there would be first be to see how are you using your moon. In the shamanic astrology paradigm, the moon is your foundation, your lineage, your instinctual self. It's kind of like the assemblage point of yourself coming into the life. And it either can be used in support of current life intent, or it can actually still be your addiction. It's like only coming from that place. Whenever there is the progressed lunar return, it's an opportunity to see whether you're actually having the moon there in support of your current life purpose. Now, if Pluto happens to be near the descendant and on the sun, that is clearly a primary Plutonian initiation. So there would be something going on, probably with reference to how you know yourself through others. It would be very interesting to know. What sign is your moon in, sorry?
Cancer.
Yeah. So if there's anything going on in your life regarding your personal relationships, you know, partner, husband, some close friendship, some longing for that. Pluto on that part of the chart is a dark night of the soul relative to that. So there could be actually a sense of I don't know whether it's possible for this to happen. I don't want to take that part of it too far, But the fact that we have the progressed moon there back at its original position, it's a test, a very deep test, that in your relational life, that you don't over-identify with the role of providing nourishment to those whom you love. You know, because that's basically an addiction. You know, like, I need to have a function. I need to have a role. I'm here to be, you know, the guy's a nurturer. I'm here to be the child that maybe you have some difficulty with. I'm here to be they're an adult now, but, you know, you still are over-identified with them being the parent, the hierarchical giver of nourishment. So it's a way of aligning or to making sure the Cancer moon is not running the show. And because with Pluto on the descendant, we can know for sure that no matter how good you are with a Cancer moon, it's not going to make any difference. There would still be something beyond your control happening there.
Right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Does it make any sense?
It does make a lot of sense to me. Thank you. And actually,
sure.
What's happened is I've lost all my relationships because I was always playing a role. And so now I can't play a role because I don't have any of those relationships.
Well, the universe is so smart, isn't it?
Yeah, and the worst case, I mean, basically the deepest fear is that that's the only way that I knew how to have good relationship. And now I've lost them. And then there can be the fear that, well, they'll never, you know, I don't know how to have them now. You know,
exactly.
But it's the confronting of that deepest fear that is where the power and the strength and the growth happens, as well as a willingness to absolutely, totally give up the Cancer moon role in trying to make them work.
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So welcome. Thank you. So let's go to the next. I think this might be Joyce.
Hi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Hey.
I have a question about, I'm having that Uranus square, Uranus. I guess I'm just out of my Jupiter and Saturn return for that time, or maybe I'm not.
Yes.
Maybe,
yeah, you're in your early 60s, right?
Mm-hmm. Just turned 61.
Okay. Got it.
So what does this Uranus square mean, Uranus? And
yeah.
I have Uranus in Cancer.
I have a lot I can share about this one. There's this sort of dense, heavy thing that happens for a lot of people, not everybody, but around this Jupiter return, Saturn return. And then it's the Uranus square that happens at 61, 62. It's a little different for different people, but it always follows the Saturn return, second Saturn return process.
Uh-huh.
And I have so many clients right now that are in this time frame, and I can look back on it because I went through it about 7 years ago. It's the opportunity to open up a phase of life that could be considered to be high adventure,
uh-huh.
to do things you've never done before, to once again what for you the adventure of life would look like. It's like in our early 60s. It would be a higher octave relative to your life phase of what the first Uranus square was, which can be anywhere. For me, it was at 20. It can be as late as 22, but it's a similar kind of thing of a high adventure, you know, like a rolling with the punches, but also in the positive sense. I said to the wind as it took me away, that's where I wanted to go today. It's like embracing it without an attachment to what you've previously accomplished or done. allowing for the assemblage point to shift and to not be at the effect of it, but to be kind of at the front of the wave rather than to being forced to do it.
Mm-hmm. So
does that make any sense?
Yeah, allowing the shift. Now, is there any stumbling blocks? Is there something I should watch out for? Does it affect anything in other relationships, this new adventure? And that's funny, I wrote that down as one of my questions, this feeling of this new adventure, what's ahead?
Right. Yeah, well, the challenge would have to do with what your habitual approach to life is. Sometimes when I have clients that are going through this one, I refer it back to the first square and also refer it back to the Uranus opposition. And sometimes an individual, when they have the first Uranus square, due to cultural overlays, parental injunctions, being a late developer, any sort of things, many things can happen that in early marriage, you know, prevent the embracing of high adventure. But then you have the opportunity again for that at 41, or, you know, the Uranus opposition. And then, amazingly enough, it comes around again in our 60s. So that
I was quite adventurous at 20, and what was it, 42, 40? 40 was the next Uranus opposition.
Somewhere in the early 40s. You can have to check in the ephemeris exactly when it was, because it's a little movable. I mean, it now, today, the Uranus opposition, is the people are going through it now. It's kind of the end of its possibilities. Around age 43, it can happen.
I was just going to say, I'd imagine, Joyce, that we're the same age, and I went through my Uranus opposition. It actually started right before I turned 39. And since you're in the same age range as me, it's very likely that you had something similar going on.
Well, yeah, those were pretty milestone marks for me. You know, 20, my adventurous coming across country. At 40, I was in a brand new relationship that I'm still in, which is quite amazing. So now I'm like looking at the 60 phase, going, so I'm holding my breath, going, it's been so good so far. What's going on now?
Elder wisdom,
right?
If you've gone through the Saturn return and you're still in that relationship, Uranus is not going to be a symbol of an ending or anything like that. What I would suggest to you is that what I would offer as suggestions about what to do would be based upon your storyline for current life purpose and the Venus position. What is your Venus?
My Venus is also in Cancer.
Okay. And then what is your rising sign?
My rising sign is Leo.
So the idea there would be, out of these adventures, out of this time of assemblage point shift and embracing it, you could be in a position, not in the cycle, but, you know, by the time the cycle is over, to be in a position of creating a completely new way of providing nourishment in the world.
Wow.
And you get to be a star while you do it.
Well, you get to be you get to enjoy it. But the idea is that it's on you, based upon what happens to you in the Uranus square, by embracing it, to come up with this brand new set of goals about how you can provide nourishment. In a healing practice, and I don't know exactly what you do, but it's beyond what you would just do with your children. You know, I mean, it's a larger story about how you can inspire the world, you know, and provide nourishment on a larger stage.
Well, that sounds like, I'm looking at it in a spiritual sense, like I better get practicing and you know, that enlighten the world business scares me a little bit, but, I mean, the best you can be is what you give to others.
A big stage doesn't mean, I mean, the thing about Cancer, right use of Venus in Cancer, is that in one stage of life it would be like the literal example of providing nourishment to your own children, but then it can also, or your own clients, or the ones you're personally most connected to.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd be moving into a phase of taking it to another level, not because of heavy responsibility, but because that would be the most remarkably enjoyable thing you could do based on the adventures you have over the night while you're in the Uranus square.
Sounds good.
And I just want to say, adventure can be actual literal travel, going to sacred sites, doing those kinds of things. But it could also be, like for me, when I was going through my Uranus opposition, I was involved in becoming a priestess, like during the priestess journey. And I wasn't traveling per se, but I was having this amazing high adventure with this whole new energy around the divine feminine. It's just to keep in mind that it could be a lot of different ways that it manifests.
Right. Well, okay, I'm going to carry on.
Yay!
Thank you so much. You guys are fantastic.
Thank you, Joyce. All right, we're going to the next person. Hello.
Hey, Kaylin, it's Carrie, and hi, Daniel, again.
Ah, yeah,
it's who?
Hi.
Who is it?
Jerry Stamper.
Okay, go.
Yeah, I just have one really quick question. By the way, I've really enjoyed this very, very much, and thank you very much for doing this. Daniel, you cut out at a time early in your teleconference when you were talking about the four crown jewels. I did not get the fourth crown jewel, and that's all I wanted to know is what is that fourth crown
this
jewel?
One. It's the timeline material.
The timeline, okay. Great.
All right. Right.
I'm getting that one as I dive deeper into my elderhood.
Yes.
That's great. Great to hear from you, Gary.
Thank you, Gary. Love you. Bye-bye.
Right, bye. Love you, too. Okay. Hello?
Hi, Kaylin. Hi, Daniel. It's Mary.
Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. And my question, I think, is real quick. Daniel made the comment that if one has Jupiter with Saturn on their chart, that the universe is very supportive. And my question is, does he mean just specifically that they're conjunct on the chart, or do oppositions and squares of those two planets also create that same situation for one?
Good question, Mary. No, conjunctions and then also trines and sextiles. But no, I'm speaking about the conjunction. No, the squares and the oppositions of Jupiter and Saturn have an additional challenge.
Okay, trines and sextiles. Didn't know that. Excellent. keep me expanding all the time. Thank you, and thanks for all you did today. Really great.
You're welcome. And I just want to say that having Saturn and Jupiter together means that what you do in the world somehow comes together in an easier way. It doesn't necessarily mean that life is easier for those people, but often when they're trying to manifest, there's an ability to manifest. And it's not always through money.
And yet, strangely enough, I mean, I'd say of all the charts I've ever done, Jupiter-Saturn conjunct, it's only every 20 years, early 40s, early 60s, early 80s, almost without exception. that almost without exception, these are individuals that even if they haven't really achieved a lot in the world, it's as if they're still having some kind of material support, which can be for good or ill. I mean, if a lot of people who achieve the most are the ones that are motivated to because of some sense of deficiency or scarcity. The Jupiter-Saturn people, if they are really motivated, well, then it's so they can pretty much accomplish anything. But the idea is, will you be motivated when your bank account is full? that may not be the case. Those individuals, it's as if they have their starting point is more established than a lot of people who have to actually get to that point where they feel secure.
Then when you said that it's more challenging if they have additional challenges if they are square or in opposition, are those specific or are they just like everybody else's?
Well, the whole inquiry with Jupiter and Saturn and their relationship with each other is how can you have what you do in the world match, it's like what your own skills or talents, I mean, how to make that work in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's as if the imagery that I used to use for this one, and it just was coming back to me right now, you're on a train, and then there's a train going by. Your train is what you do well. The other train is what the world needs to have done. And if it's a square or an opposition, it's a little harder to get those trains lined up so you can jump on the other train. But if it's a conjunction, then it's like the trains are in alignment.
Got it. Okay. That's a very good explanation. Thank you.
Indeed. Yes. Okay, so let's go to the next person. Hello.
Hi. Oh, let's see. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Who is this?
Okay, great. Hi, this is Shima. I had a reading with Daniel a long time ago, and the last few months I've just been so totally engrossed with your material again. I don't know if for some reason you've come around, and I've just been watching your videos. I'm so excited. This was a great great tele-summit, so thank you. My question is, my Venus is in Aries, and mm-hmm. I'm 70, and I'm kind of surprised that I don't understand why I'm not having a Venus return. I thought my Venus is like 8 degrees Aries. Am I not having a Venus return?
Well, you, the Venus is the meta goddess is in Aries. You won't probably start your Venus return because you won't turn 72 until after the next cycle starts. So that next cycle will be your Venus return, and that starts November 1st of 2018. When do you turn 72?
In May, I just turned 70.
You just turned 70, yeah. So you'll mm-hmm. turn 72 in May of 2018? No,
2019. Mm-hmm.
2019, yeah. So the next cycle will have started. So it's an every 8-year thing. But this cycle would be significant to you because you have Venus in Aries. I also have Venus in Aries, so I'm closely watching this, yeah.
Yeah, the cycle that replicates the original Venus position on your chart is every 8 years. So Venus goes into Aries every year, but the recreation of the Venus cycle where it matches where it was at your birthday, that's only every 8 years.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I was very confused. It just wasn't computing for me. And then the other question I had in terms of the different realms, I have Neptune conjunct Moon, and so I really relate a lot to the celestial levels.
Yes.
I seem to have always a challenging time, although I do a lot of things, you know, on some levels in the middle world, it's like it doesn't really come together like in the financial arena. But
right.
I'm out there doing a lot of things. So does that make me a more of a celestial type of person? Is that kind of what's happening?
What sign is your moon in?
In Libra.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Regardless of what the moon is, which in this system is your lineage, if you come in with Neptune conjuncted, it's as if something Piscean, you know, something celestial has... overlaid the moon, so that surely your primary way of experiencing life early on was through the celestial realm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an up leveling way of putting it. But on a more practical level, it also could mean that that you would be how do we put it? The positive way of saying it, I guess, is that very empathic and sensitive to the emotional and celestial environment around you. That would be the purpose of having Neptune there. You know, it kind of overemphasizes your ability to connect with the heart and soul of the feminine, one reality. You know, the celestial realm that we find ourselves in. You know, Neptune on the moon will, for good or ill, produce that effect.
Uh-huh, yes. Well, it's certainly good in a lot of ways. More recently, I've been really getting into it. And last year, I discovered that my time was wrong on my chart, and my son went into the 12th house. And I had been studying ancient astrology and all this dire stuff about the 12th house, and I was like, it went from the 11th to the 12th. So, but now studying your work, I'm getting more of a hopeful sense that it is again just plugging into that Piscean 12th house energy.
Well, did the different birth time, did it give you a different rising sign?
Yes, I went from Cancer rising.
Well, that's the most important thing. So what is the new rising
Gemini.
Sign?
Now it's Gemini.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean...
And the sign of your sun?
Taurus,
okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
The really good news there, if you have Venus in Aries and Gemini rising, whenever we see that combination, and that includes the Neptune effect on your moon, is that your later years are your eternal youth years.
Great.
Yay.
Yay. Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm doing I'm on my fifth day of a master cleanse, and I call it the Ageless Vitality Master Cleanse. So I can really relate to that. Yeah, great. Well, thank you
so
much.
Well, you should really enjoy the 72 time period, because we addressed that before along the timeline, that's a Venus return, Venus and Aries, but also it's the next Jupiter return.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, beautiful. Magical time. Yeah, so you have that to look forward to. Woohoo.
Yay. I love it. Yay. I thought I had something to look forward to in my 70s. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Awesome. Bye. So that is our last person in the queue. So I think we're ready to wrap this up. And we're just a little bit past our time here. So any last remarks you want to make, Daniel?
We're hoping that you've enjoyed this so much that you would consider becoming a member of the school, and take a few minutes to look at the various benefits that come from being a member of the school, and at the very least, make sure you're getting the newsletter and see all the kinds of things on the website that are resources for researching and taking this further. If you don't already have it, I would suggest getting the Shamanic Astrology Handbook. And very soon now, by July, my new book will become available, Origins of the Shamanic Astrology Paradigm, which is finally to come together. And that'll be available shortly. Yep.
Yay. And I would just also say, if this has had value for you, you're not feeling inspired to be a member, but you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation, we would love that support because we want to keep putting this information out into the world in a way that people can connect with it and have it benefit their lives. And that's really what we're all about here. So thank you so much for being a part of this, whether you're listening live or later on the recording. And we hope that everyone has a really amazing and magical solstice experience. So.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kaylin. Yeah. This has been
thank
fun
you.
Doing this together with you again. Talk
yes,
to you all soon.
Yes, thank you, Daniel. Okay, bye everyone. Bye.